Hi, my name is Christina Phillips. I'm a producer for The Exchange at New Hampshire Public Radio. And this is a great program, I think, for people who think they know everything about the state and people who don't know anything about the state. I feel like every week we talk about topics that you may know a lot about, or you might learn something completely new, but every time you're getting to hear from experts, people who care a lot about these issues, people who maybe have not gotten to have their voice on the radio before. It's a great way to learn a lot of things about what makes our state tick and what's important to people around the state. And so if you use this service, if you subscribe to the podcast and you think it's an important part of your life, you should definitely try to support that, whether it's $5, $10, or even $20. Giving is really easy to do. You just go to nhpr.org, or you can follow the link right there in the show notes. And thanks.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Scientists call them vector-borne diseases, and you've probably heard of some of them: Lyme, West Nile, Tripoli, and maybe a few others, such as anaplasmosis. But in a recent report, the Federal Centers for Disease Control says it's now tracking 16 of these illnesses transmitted by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. And the CDC says the total number of cases has tripled over the time period it studied, from 2004 to 2016. Within that data, ticks, it says, are public enemy number one, accounting for more than 60% of all reported vector-borne diseases. Today in The Exchange, what's happening with these bug-borne illnesses and what should our response be? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Both our guests join us from a studio in Hanover. Dr. Elizabeth Talbot is with us, associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College, where she specializes in infectious disease and international health. And Dr. Talbot, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
Also with us, Jonathan Winter, assistant professor of geography at Dartmouth College, who has studied the impact of climate change on northern New England. And Jonathan, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, both of you, but Jonathan, you first. The numbers seem staggering, that tripling that I mentioned in terms of the number of cases of these diseases over that period. What do you make of this, Jonathan?
Well, so if you unpack the numbers a little bit, what you'll see is over this time period that the CDC looked at, which is 2004 through 2016, like you said, the vector-borne diseases tripled, and this was driven primarily by a doubling of the tick-borne diseases and also a 2016 spike in Zika cases. And if you look overall at the contribution of tick-borne diseases to vector-borne diseases, it's almost 80%. And then Lyme is 80% of that. So really, a lot of this is being driven at its heart by Lyme disease. Of course, you have other tick-borne diseases, which we'll talk about, that are also on the rise.
Well, and Jonathan, sometimes when we see huge jumps like this, it's because people are just more aware and they're reporting more. We've seen this with other illnesses. How much might that be part of the story, Jonathan?
Well, so I think it might be part of the story, but we've also just seen an increase in the number of ticks, an expansion of the tick's range, the black-legged tick, which is the one of most concern when it comes to Lyme. So I don't think it's completely just more reporting. I think there's certainly more Lyme out there and more ticks out there as well.
Well, and Dr. Talbot, based on your work and what you see with the patients you work with, does this sound plausible, this giant increase in vector-borne diseases?
Yeah, this is an intersection of several different things converging to create these numbers that are pretty scary sometimes. But I do believe that the public has a greater awareness of the dangers of tick bites, and clinicians are also increasingly aware of these diseases and more likely to report appropriately to the health department, so our surveillance improves.
So part of it is, Dr. Talbot, people being more aware, and part of it is just what Jonathan said, there's just more of these nasty critters out there.
I think that's right.
Jonathan, can you talk about the wider range of ticks that you mentioned and why we're seeing more of them in places that, you know, 20 years ago they didn't show up?
Yeah, sure. So so the ticks in particular, we have really two big tick species in New Hampshire. So one that we're concerned about, and that's the black-legged tick or the deer tick. And the other one that we're less concerned about, and that's the American dog tick. And that one does not transmit Lyme. So in terms of the black-legged tick and just ticks overall and why we have more of them, there are kind of two prevailing theories. So the first one is changing land use. So since the Northeast stopped farming as much, you've had reforestation, and then you've also had this habitat fragmentation. And this is us moving with our suburbs and expanding our rural areas to get more into the forest. So you're basically taking a big chunk of forest or habitat and you're breaking it into small pieces. And there are a couple of things that happen when you break this big habitat into small pieces. Typically, you decrease the biodiversity of the patch itself, so the patch of land. And two animals that really like this are deer and mice, or small rodents. And this is a concern because those two animals are key drivers of both tick populations and Lyme. So deer are a food source for the ticks, and mice are both a food source and the vehicle by which the ticks get Lyme. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But it's really the increases in these host populations that's causing the increase in ticks. And then also what we do is related to that, as we clear this land and break up this habitat, we're also moving into it. So we're moving ourselves right next to both the hosts that carry the Lyme disease and also the ticks that can transmit it to us. So changing land use is really one. And then the other one, and the one that I'm more interested in through my research, is a potential impact of climate. So has climate change or increasing temperatures caused expanded tick ranges? And here there are a couple ways in which we think the warming climate could increase the amount of ticks. And the first one is ticks don't like cold weather. So if you get a tick down to about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, it'll die. And it's a little bit more subtle than that, because the ticks go down into the duff underneath the leaf litter during the winter. So it's not like a 10 degree air temperature that you feel of 10 degrees is going to kill them. It's really got to get much colder than that. But the idea is, as temperatures warm, as we have warmer winters, the ticks no longer get killed, so they can expand their range northward. And then it also, just having warmer temperatures throughout the year, it increases the length of the tick season. So they have more of an opportunity to be out. They're not going to be very active at temperatures below 40. They're going to be much more active above that. So they'll start moving around and seeking hosts and transmitting Lyme disease and expanding their population.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan. Sorry.
And then the last aspect of climate is increases in rainfall. So
right.
So ticks in particular like humidity. They need humidity. You don't find these type of ticks in the desert Southwest. They'll desiccate. They'll dry out. So over the last 30 years or so, the Northeast has experienced more rainfall than it has previous to that. So that could be a contributing factor.
Okay, so a couple things to follow up on. That's really interesting. And I do remember in 2016 when we had that drought, people said, hey, one upside, the ticks don't like
exactly.
this. But you talked about cold temperatures, and I hear you that they hide in the leaf litter, so it's a little bit warmer under there. Still, Jonathan, it was freezing for a week or two or three this winter, you know, right around Christmas time, I think. I mean, really sub-zero for many, many days at a time. Did that hurt the ticks?
Yeah, so I mean, it did. There are some ticks that certainly die in those cold, but you know, they can get underneath. They can get a little bit down in the soil. If you have snow on the ground, that also forms like an insulative layer. So even though it seems like a relatively easy threshold to cross here in New Hampshire, you know, they're survivors, so they can burrow down and stay warm enough to basically get through the winter.
Well, you talked about leaf litter, and I wonder, so is that an argument for really raking your yard down to the bare bones, so that there's less leaf litter for ticks to hang out?
So I think in your yard, so ticks don't particularly like yards anyway, because they're exposed in the summer to sunlight, so they'd much prefer forests. So if you want to, so it's really not a plausible idea to go out and basically clear all the leaf litter out of your forest. So I would say probably not really on that one.
Okay. Well, and to this point about, you know, a good year for ticks, a bad year for ticks, Russell sent us an email. He says, overall, I was wondering how this year is turning out. I live in Vermont on the border of New Hampshire. Last year, my son and I would pull off 4 to 5 ticks a week each when in the garden. This year, neither one of us has gotten one yet, which I am so thankful for, Russell says. He says, we are very vigilant on checking for ticks every morning and night, those nasty little critters. Russell, thank you so much. Too early to tell, Jonathan, about what kind of a tick year it's going to be?
I think so, because we haven't really reached the heart of the summer yet. I mean, it's early in the season, so really you have May, June, and July, excuse me, that will be your main tick months where you'll have the most kind of bites. I've pulled a couple off my family, but yeah, I think it's a little early to tell.
Okay, well, Russell, thank you for the email. And you can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter as well. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, NHPR Exchange. Or the number, 1-800-892-6477. And as both of you can imagine, we got lots of questions from our listeners even before the show began. With this Northern New England focus that we're taking now on this issue, Fred sent us a tweet, and I'll throw this to you, Dr. Talbot. He says, everyone talks about Lyme. What about the other bacteria infections you can get? I had one it took the doctor weeks to identify. Fred, thank you so much, because from what I understand, Dr. Talbot, it's a lot more than just Lyme these days.
You're right. Unfortunately, we're watching now 5 diseases that are transmitted by ticks in New Hampshire. So everyone has heard about Lyme disease, but we're also learning a lot. We're steep on the learning curve for Anaplasma, a disease that's caused by Anaplasma phagocytophilum, Babesia, another tick-borne disease, Powassan virus, and there's a new kid on the block. It's Borrelia miyamotoi.
Wow.
So a very unusual name, but many experts believe that we're probably underdiagnosing that. So part of the rise in the vector-borne diseases that are being seen, not only awareness, not only tick changes, but also improvements in our ability to diagnose them. So we have 5 diseases that are transmitted by this black-legged tick or the Ixodes scapularis tick.
Wow. And just a couple of years ago, we were only talking about Lyme. Now we have these others to worry about. Which ones of these, do you know, Dr. Talbot, are hardest to treat? Part of the reason I ask is a colleague of my husband's got babesiosis a couple years ago, and still she is unable to work full time, just really knocked out by this.
Oh, I hate to hear those stories. There are prescribed treatments for sure. That's one message that needs to be heard loud and clear, that we have effective treatments. Sometimes patients are especially vulnerable if their immune systems don't work well in concert with these antibiotics, but in general, I think that the message is that if the clinician thinks of these diseases, the patient presents for diagnosis, that there are treatments available, and generally they're highly efficient and highly effective.
Well, and I appreciate the good news, and I'd love to ask both of you, Dr. Talbot, you first, what other good news is there in this kind of depressing topic, frankly, about vector-borne diseases? Go ahead, Dr. Talbot, you first.
Right. I think it's not a very, I don't know, sexy topic. I think people get awfully tired of hearing it. But I truly believe that there are ways that people can effectively prevent these diseases. So we all know about DEET, right? Nobody likes how it smells. You don't have it when you need it, that kind of thing. So we need to just change our lifestyle. We have to have it in our glove box, a small amount in our purse, whatever. We need to have it available when we need it and when we find ourselves in places where ticks are roaming and mosquitoes are biting. There are other tricks of the trade, though, and that includes one of my favorites, especially in international travel, which is permethrin. This is a long-known chemical that binds to fibers of clothing. This is not something you put on your skin, but is highly effective if you, for example, treat your shoelaces, the cloth of your shoes, your socks, your pants, your clothes, and it lasts for up to 20 washes, depending on what formulation. you purchase, and again, routinely available in most hardware stores or Walmart type stores. So I think that this is something underutilized. Another strategy that's very intuitive is light colored clothing, right? So I think that we don't have it firmly entrenched enough that when we think, I'm going to go enjoy our beautiful state, I'm going to go out and hike, I'm going to be in the woods, let me wear white, let me wear khaki colors, because that's an effective way of identifying when ticks are looking for their blood meal, crawling up your leg. If you wear dark colors, it's much harder to see, and it's much harder to pluck them off before they get that bite.
Well, if I could ask you another question about the permethrin. I'm probably not doing this the right way. I've been spraying my socks and shoes with DEET before I go out, but it sounds like I should be using permethrin instead, Dr. Talbot.
That's right. So DEET is formulated for application to your skin. And of course, the formulation that you purchase will have very specific instructions, including don't put it around your mouth and don't put it on children's hands and et cetera. But it's for your skin. And it's permethrin that is the available chemical that you can treat your clothing for your summer activities. A lot of the stores have picked up on this trick. So they'll sell you permethrin impregnated clothing, but you can certainly do that cheaply by yourself.
Wow. Okay. And we always, when we talk about this topic, get lots of questions from listeners about appropriate repellents. So there's some valuable information. NHPR Something Wild also talked to Sarah McGregor of Dragon Mosquito Control about what she feels is protective. She told the Something Wild folks that scented oils and other natural remedies aren't quite protective enough. Let's hear.
Nothing compares to the DEET, okay. Really. And I always stress that during the disease part of the season, you don't want to take a chance if there's a mosquito out there carrying disease in your community that you're not repelling it. And maybe that's another little sidebar here is that the mosquitoes in the spring are annoying, but they're not carrying diseases. It's the mosquitoes that are coming out in July, August, September, October that are the disease threat.
Again, that's Sarah McGregor of Dragon Mosquito Control talking to NHPR's Something Wild. Jonathan, your broad thoughts on sort of the seasons and the cycles of when we should especially be thinking about these vector-borne illnesses.
Yeah, so in terms of the seasons and the cycles, really have your tick checks honed mid-May through mid-July.
So right now, basically.
Right now, because that's when we see the most transmission. So the way the tick cycle works is they live for 2 years. They take three different meals, and you don't have to worry about the first one, which is when they're larvas and they're very small. But the one that you most have to worry about is now, because right now the nymphs are feeding, and the nymphs are still very small. So when you talk about a deer tick, a nymph will be about the size of like a poppy seed or a pinhead, like very small, very difficult to see. You have to look very closely. And these can be infected with Lyme, so they can pass the Lyme disease virus, or they can give you Lyme disease. And they're tough to see. Now, you can also get Lyme disease from the adult tick, but the adult tick is bigger. So you have more of a chance of seeing that and pulling it off. And remember, for Lyme disease, one of the good news things about Lyme disease is it takes a while to transmit. So if you catch it, if you catch the tick within, say, 36 to 48 hours, the rates of transmission go down substantially. So, that's the good thing about Lyme disease is, like, if you do tick checks, if you just get them off of you, you can really reduce your vulnerability to the disease itself.
All right. Coming up, I'm going to ask both of you about any more good news that you can share with our listeners. And also, Dr. Talbot, I'm going to ask you why, we always get this question, why there isn't still a vaccine for these vector-borne illnesses that people are so concerned about. So all that's coming up, plus a lot more of your comments and questions. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Also coming up, a Plymouth State researcher's unique project on ticks. She wants you to get involved, so we'll find out about that as well. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, vector-borne diseases. These are illnesses transmitted by the bites of ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. And unfortunately, the CDC says they are definitely on the rise. We're getting a New Hampshire take on this and hearing about prevention. There's a little bit of good news there. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Both our guests join us from Hanover, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College, where she specializes in infectious disease and international health. And Jonathan Winter, assistant professor of geography at Dartmouth College. He studies the impact of climate change on northern New England. And both of you, right back to our listeners. Kate is calling in from Drewsville. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I got Lyme disease almost maybe even more than 30 years ago. I was living on Martha's Vineyard, and I was treated right away. Never had any repercussions. Now I live in New Hampshire. And I think I live in a particularly tick-infested area. I pull a lot of ticks off myself.
Yikes.
Like 15 already this spring. And I've never had Lyme disease since. And I have pulled so many ticks off myself. And I'm just wondering if it's possible that some people develop an immunity after having Lyme disease once.
Oh, Kate, that's really interesting. I had not thought about that. Dr. Talbot, do you know?
I know that there's a lot we don't know about having Lyme disease and the possibility of having it again. So what the most common experience is that you can get it more than once. But I'm glad to hear of your experience, and I hope that's true of other people as well. I just think we have to stay vigilant, even if you've had Lyme before, that you may be susceptible to get it again.
Well, and I'm glad you haven't, Kate. And your question relates to one that Thomas sent us, who says, what percentage of ticks actually carry Lyme disease? And the latest numbers, Thomas, that we have from DHHS say about 60%, which is an increase from what we used to talk about years ago. Also, Thomas asks, what purpose do ticks serve in the world? And Jonathan, what do you think?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and I really wish I could have a great answer of how they support an entire part of our ecosystem that we really value. But it's, you know, it's really, ticks might be good for other things, but are generally not good for us. So so basically, there are a couple things that ticks do. So the microorganisms that cause disease, they're called spirochetes. They couldn't exist without a tick. You know, ticks do have a role in culling host populations, so basically reducing the populations that they feed on. And that could potentially help us with overgrazing or destruction of vegetation. And then the ticks themselves can serve as food sources for things like reptiles and birds and amphibians. But really, the evidence here is that they're kind of a marginal food source. Nobody really depends on ticks as their primary prey. So again, I wish I had a great answer of how beneficial ticks were in another part of our ecosystem.
Well, and in
but they're really not.
Yeah,
they're really not particularly helpful to us in any way.
Well, in the Something Wild episode that we played a little bit from earlier with Sarah McGregor, she talked about the important role that mosquitoes play in the ecosystem for fish, for birds, for reptiles, and so forth. But you seem to be saying, Jonathan, when it comes to ticks, not so much.
Yeah, I just haven't seen the evidence that they're a big... So mosquitoes, potentially, in terms of their being a big food source for other animals. But for ticks, it seems like they're less of a food source.
All right. Well, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Caitlin Morris is with us. She's a biology lecturer at Plymouth State University and creator of Bebop Labs, a project to collect ticks from the public for study. And Caitlin, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, I'm here representing Bebop Labs. Bebop Labs collaborates with Plymouth State University, but we're not representing their project today. It's very similar but different, also filling in knowledge gaps. It's still a cool project, but I'm going to talk about what Bebop Labs does.
Well, so let's talk about that. So you are collecting ticks from the public, right, Caitlin? Having people mail them to you? So what's the goal there?
Yeah, so what Bebop Labs is doing gathering ticks is called crowdsourcing, and we're doing this for a couple of reasons. One is to encourage hands-on, open-source, equal opportunity to science, changing how knowledge is made and keeping it collaborative, which is important for today's discoveries. But we're also doing it because crowdsourcing is the best way to get data on ticks, because we get ticks that bite humans and we get the ticks where people are going.
So crowdsourcing tick collection, you want people to send them to you in the mail, like live still, Caitlin? Just wrap them up in an envelope and send them?
Yeah, so what we ask for people to do is to put them in like a Ziploc bag. Some people put them in tape and write down the date that they found them, where they think they found the tick. And if it was crawling or biting on them, specifically if it's biting, where it was found on their body. And we don't care what species of ticks have actually got some needles too, because some people don't understand what ticks look like. But so we get a bunch of different species of ticks and identify the species. And then if they are black-legged ticks or Ixodes scapularis, we test them for disease. Well, that's the plan, at least. I'm just getting started, so that's what we're looking to do.
And are you focused on any particular part of the state, Caitlin, or do you want people to mail you their ticks from all over the state?
Yeah, so I am focused on northern New Hampshire, Grafton, Carroll, and Collett counties. However, we've received ticks from the southern part of the state, as well as Mass and Connecticut and Maine. So I'm looking at that because there's very little information in the northern New Hampshire, and we don't really know. We know that ticks are increasing. Their evidence shows that they're changing their breeding seasons, correlating to climate change, but we don't know how far north that occurs. So we're working really hard to try to answer that question.
So do you think that there's a sense, Caitlin, that in northern New Hampshire, it's not as much of a problem?
So far I've collected over 200 dog ticks and about 25 black-legged ticks. And the black-legged ticks have come out later in the month of May. So this is just for May this year, those numbers that I just gave you. I'm just starting to correlate or inventory the ticks from June, which we just started the month. So, so the 25 black-legged ticks that I found have started within the last few weeks of May. And last year, I did a preliminary study with very limited data from, like, I had 50 ticks and I tested them. And I did find about 25% of the black-legged ticks carry Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the agent for Lyme disease. We see it, and I think it's really changing. What I've noticed is, we have a lot of dog ticks, but I think for the month of June, even though I kind of disproved my hypothesis where I saw less black-legged ticks than dog ticks for May, I think we're going to start seeing more as we continue throughout the month of June and July.
Well,
and throughout the year.
Plenty for you to look at, unfortunately. Caitlin, I want to let people know that we have on our website all the information if people want to mail their ticks to you. So I'll direct folks there, nhpr.org, if you want to mail your ticks to Caitlin. And Caitlin, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
That's Caitlin Morse, again, creator of Bebop Labs, a project to crowdsource, as she said, or collect ticks from the public for further study. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, with your questions right now about vector-borne diseases. Now, these are illnesses transmitted not just by ticks, but also mosquitoes and fleas, and we're finding out more about this. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Jonathan and Dr. Talbot, let's go right back to our listeners. Mark's in Portsmouth. Hi, Mark. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you guys know if anybody in the global north is trying to develop any gene drives that could kind of engineer a tick that maybe can't reproduce or that has a resistant gene that's being introduced into the population like they've done in the global south for malaria.
Interesting. And I have, Mark, read a little bit about, the idea of using some type of gene therapy or gene editing for this. Dr. Talbot, this is emerging. Do you know anything about this?
No. I know that, as you mentioned, this is being looked at much more closely and in an advanced way for mosquito-borne disease. So I feel optimistic that this line of research may result in some real transformative results, but you know, we just don't have it in hand right now. It's certainly not imminent for us.
Well, and this raises the other question. Mark, thank you for the call, by the way. Why, Dr. Talbot, is there still no vaccine, even with all the threats that the CDC outlines?
Right. Good question. You know, for disease control, we need an aware public and clinicians who know when to send diagnostics. We need good diagnostics. We need these treatments and vector control, these tick control and mosquito control strategies. But we ultimately need a vaccine that's going to halt this process in humans. We had a vaccine. It was called Lymerix. It was FDA approved. It was unanimously FDA approved for use, and it had a tremendous uptake when it was released. There was voiced a theoretical concern that it might engender an autoimmune disease, that is, turning a vaccine recipient's immune system against the person getting the vaccine. So, it was theoretical, and yet there were a few lawsuits that arose after the release of the vaccine, and the uptake fell way down, and I think it was no longer a viable option. But many of your listeners will know that the Lyme vaccine exists and is effective for your pets, so it's used for dogs. But right now, we need to do better with regards to our vaccine availability.
Well, so in terms of the vaccine, I have to ask you this one more question. I have read more recently about development of a vaccine that isn't just aimed at Lyme, but aimed more broadly at many of these vector-borne illnesses. I think ticks in particular, which would seem to make more sense given the development, right, Dr. Talbot, of these other tick-borne diseases that you're looking at. Like, it's not
sure,
just enough to be, you know, targeted at Lyme. Go ahead.
No, you're right. It would be far more effective to somehow disable a tick from transmitting any of these diseases, or to engender in the population a resistance. So, can we develop a vaccine that covers all five of these diseases? That seems unlikely, but I've heard of strategies against, for example, mosquito saliva as a way of aborting any incipient infection. So this is relevant for diseases like Zika virus. But I have not heard that there's anything particularly imminent to cover all the diseases that we know about and all the diseases we don't know about that these ticks can transmit.
Wow, so nothing imminent, nothing that, you know, we can get next year.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing that I know of, for sure.
Okay, so go get some permethrin, I guess, would be
that's right.
Your advice for, you know, frustrated Granite Staters. Most of us live here because we love to get outdoors. So, you know, you get a little bit tired of the tick checks and the worry and all that.
Absolutely.
Here's another question that came in from Jason, and I'll throw this to you, Jonathan. He says, we treat our yard for ticks and mosquitoes using a service, JP Pest. Jason says, what's the trade-off, though, ecologically by doing this? He says, I want to get rid of the bad guys, but not the good things like bees and birds, etc. And Jason, I appreciate the question. We're doing a show on bees later this month, and there's huge concern about the health of the bee population. So great question. And Jonathan, can you help us out?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it really depend on what kind of pesticide was being used on the lawn. So kind of how broad a spectrum it was and how broad of an insect population it would actually impact. So without knowing that, I'm not exactly sure what kind of impact it would have on the environment. But what I could jump in with is there are some things that you can do kind of short of treating your lawn, and treating your lawn is fine. It's a perfectly acceptable method to keep the tick population down. As I mentioned earlier in the show, ticks really need a humid environment. They don't like it dry. So things like keeping your grass short, making sure there's no brush on your lawn, a buffer strip of wood chips or a mowed border. These are all ways to basically keep black-legged ticks out in the forest and not have them basically migrate onto your lawn because they'll find it basically too hot, too dry, not enough cover to basically burrow under. And then also just keeping people away from any shrubs and tall grass that you do have.
Well, and speaking of lawns, here's an email from Barbara in Goffstown who says, just heard about ticks not liking yards, yet my yard, Barbara says, has exploded with ticks. It has also exploded with voles. Wood voles who burrow underground be carriers of ticks. Barbara says, my watering cans are kept by my rain barrel. Every morning there are ticks on the cans. Yikes, Barbara. She says, this is also a big area for vole holes, so that's why I'm questioning the connection. And Barbara, thank you so much. So you mentioned earlier, Jonathan, that mice carry ticks. What about voles? They sort of look like
absolutely.
Mice.
Absolutely. Yeah, small rodents.
Any small rodents are problematic.
Any small rodents are particularly susceptible to the larvae and the nymph stages of ticks. They'll look to feed on those.
And the last time we did this this topic, I remember someone said that possums were tick vacuums. And I've heard this repeated a couple times. Do you know anything about that, Jonathan? Should we all adopt a couple pet possums and put them in our backyards?
Yeah, so I haven't heard about possums being used for tick control overall, just having like a herd of possums in your
yard.
Yeah.
But I'm being a little
bit silly
there,
they're really great at grooming themselves. They do excellent tick checks. So they do eat ticks. So they basically do tick checks, they pull them off and they eat them.
All right. Well, again, speaking of mice, Alan in Durham says it might be a coincidence, but I've had far fewer ticks in the past few years since reducing the mice population near my house. Alan says I use a combination of mouse bait and cardboard tubes filled with permethrin soaked cotton. Though we usually hear about deer, Alan says, I think mice are the key cog in the Lyme disease cycle. So thank you, Alan, for that. Back to our callers, and Deb's calling from Milford. Hi, Deb. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning. So my question was, my husband recently was bit. We discovered it, unfortunately, not soon enough before the bite. It had probably been 24 hours or better. Went to the doctor. In this case, it was a skin doctor. He actually had been scheduled to see. We gave him the tick. So we took the tick, we removed the tick, we found it. He was going in that morning, took the tick, brought it in. They sent it off for analysis because this was an engorged tick. And they were waiting now for the DNA, and I'm not sure what the DNA component is that they're looking for that on the tick itself.
So you're wondering about the testing, Deb, it sounds like, and how they test, what they're testing for, and how long it takes. And Donald also sent us an email with a similar question. How do you test for these five tick-borne diseases, Donald says? Is there any improvement in spotty Lyme testing? Go ahead, Dr. Talbot, that one's for you.
It raises the issue that one aspect of prevention here is, just as you say, Deb, that if you are able to identify that tick, you do your tick check and you find the critter and it's been attached for at least 36 hours, then you're a candidate, a person's a candidate to get a single dose of doxycycline, which can abort disease. So we certainly encourage clinicians to be aware of this strategy. First, you have to make sure that it is an Ixodes scapularis tick. You need to have that time frame of tick on for at least 36 hours and within 72 hours of pulling that tick off. And you also have to be able to tolerate the doxycycline, the drug that's given in that single dose. So this is a very important strategy. What I hear in your question, though, Deb, is something I didn't just mention, which is there's no tick testing that's involved in that. You have to identify the species for sure, but we don't make a decision about whether to provide that doxycycline based on how that tick tests. There are strategies, surveillance for the tick-borne diseases in ticks, for sure, as we've discussed, but that's so that we understand how these diseases are moving around the state and how different populations are vulnerable.
And Dr. Talbot, I'm so sorry. I got to jump in there for a sec, but we will pick that up after a short break because it's an important question. Stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39.
Kate Spade built more than a $1 billion brand. She helped define American fashion. For many young women, their first Kate Spade was a rite of passage. Her range and her prices laid a path for others to follow and admire. Millions are mourning Kate Spade's death this week. Her fashion and the industry's future, next time on 1A.
That's This Morning at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit specializing in college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org. and from Massachusetts General Hospital using research to develop treatments for complex conditions, all to help their patients get back to their lives. Mass General, revolutionizing care. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with host Peter Biello. This hour, we're looking at the increase in bug-borne diseases, specifically ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. We're talking about prevention, and let's get you involved. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests join us from Hanover. They are Jonathan Winter, an assistant professor of geography at Dartmouth College. He studies the impact of climate change on northern New England. Dr. Elizabeth Talbot is also with us, an associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, where she specializes in infectious disease and international health. And it's in that area that I want to turn to now, just briefly with you, Dr. Talbot. In its report on vector-borne diseases, the CDC also talks about the impact of overseas travel, overseas commerce. How is that affecting this bigger vector-borne disease picture, Dr. Talbot?
Sure. This is a well-known contribution to the movement of disease globally. So I think everybody's heard of West Nile virus, whose name suggests that it is not endemic or typically found in the United States. So humans move diseases around the planet all the time. So indeed, we've seen that happen most recently and relevantly with Zika virus, right? So folks who have come back from the Americas or the Caribbean have had Zika virus in their blood, and then the local mosquitoes, the U.S. mosquitoes, are able to bite that person and further transmit. So a very well-known phenomenon in disease epidemiology and the movement of infectious diseases globally.
I see. So someone with Zika gets bitten by a mosquito, and then that mosquito bites someone else, transmitting it that way. Wow, that's kind of chilling, Dr. Talbot.
Yes, it is. I agree with you, and that definitely keeps me in business as an infectious disease epidemiologist. I also have been stunned to learn of malaria that happens around airports, for example, in the U.S., and that's a result of mosquitoes being able to travel in the, you know, tires that are being transmitted by boats, or the hold of planes, where the bugs themselves, the vectors themselves, can move around the planet.
Well, and once you start looking into this, you know, it's pretty easy to become alarmed. And Jonathan, I wonder what you think about public education. The CDC is all over this. You know, the public needs to understand what the threats are, take the right measures. We've talked about a lot of those measures. What kind of public messaging do you think, Jonathan, is helpful? And what reaches the point of scaring people from, you know, going outside?
Yeah, so, I mean, it is a balance to walk because, I mean, certainly the CDC doesn't want everybody, and the people that study this, like myself and Dr. Talbot, don't want everybody to just curl up in a ball and be inside. You want to get out. But that's really why the personal prevention measures that we've talked about are so important, and including things like permethrin and DEET. And also, I think there's a big role for local governments to step up and really identify places that have the largest amount of tick populations and kind of the largest the places where you're most likely to catch Lyme disease, so people can avoid those areas, especially you know, in this peak season of May through July.
Well, and here's another question about the idea of tick control using chemicals. Ken wrote us an email. He says, I use a professional spray service to kill ticks. I'm worried that it kills bees and pollutes my well water and the stream nearby. Should I worry about it? Now, Jonathan, we talked earlier about, you know, the impact of some of these tick control measures on other types of critters. But what about water pollution? Ken, thank you for the question.
Yeah, so I don't want to get too far outside my area of expertise. I'm not exactly sure. Certainly, you have a pesticide on a lawn, you'll have rainfall, it will run off in some way. But the safety of that being in your well water and whether it can get down there is really dependent on the chemical. So it would be difficult for me to speculate.
And just reiterate what you told us earlier about the concern that a chemical sprayed to control ticks would or would not hurt beneficial bugs like bees.
Well, so I think it would depend, and again, this is a little bit outside my area of expertise, but it would just depend on what chemical it was and how broad of a spectrum it took. So there are chemicals that are really focused only on ticks themselves, and then there are chemicals that are kind of more broadly focused on insects, arthropods, things like that. So it would depend on the chemical.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Ken. It's a good question. And here's another one. This is from Joan, who says, is the medication for dogs effective? Dr. Talbot, we've also gotten questions from people asking, hey, you know, my 150-pound dog has tick prevention and tick protection. Why not me? Have you gotten that question from patients, Dr. Talbot? Like, can I use my dog's medication?
So, as mentioned earlier, there is an effective vaccine for dogs, right? So that is not licensed for use in humans. We did have that vaccine, Limerix, but for those complicated reasons, that's no longer available to us. When your pet gets Lyme disease, I understand the veterinarians use the same type of antibiotics, and those antibiotics are approved and quality assured through veterinary mechanisms and are never appropriate for a human to take. But it's the same class of antibiotics that is effective against that Borrelia burgdorferi, the etiology of Lyme.
Wow. So never appropriate for humans to take, even though it's the same basic chemical compound, Dr. Talbot?
I think that's the safest answer right here, absolutely, that the veterinarian formulations may be different, have different vehicles, have different quality assurance, and a human should not take veterinarian medicine.
Well, and we've talked a lot about ticks, and clearly that's a big concern here in northern New England. But Dr. Talbot, we should talk a little bit more about two other insects that the CDC mentions in its report, mosquitoes and fleas. Now, what other vector-borne illnesses are you looking at transmitted either through mosquitoes or fleas?
I think what's relevant to New Hampshire are the mosquito-borne diseases, more than flea-borne diseases. So our mosquito populations in New Hampshire are capable of transmitting several different diseases. We've mentioned West Nile, but that's somewhat fallen out of endemicity or commonness in our region. But we watch at the end of our summer for the very dreaded disease of Eastern equine encephalitis. This is a viral disease transmitted by mosquito that can be neurologically devastating. That is, affect the brain and have a high mortality and result in sequela. So it brings us back again to the importance of trying to prevent insects from biting you when you're out and about.
Wow. So triple E is something that you sound very concerned about and happens more at the end of the summer, Dr. Talbot?
That's been the epidemiology in New Hampshire, that the cases that we've identified have presented at the late part of the summer, but they're very few. This is always that balancing act of not scaring folks and not having them enjoy our beautiful state, and yet we want people to be empowered in order to take action against getting these diseases.
So I'm picturing you going out in the woods, Dr. Talbot, with your permethrin-coated socks and shoes and pants. And then what else do? You wear long sleeves? You spray your head? What do you do?
Yeah, right. So I am attentive to using DEET.
I bet.
Especially. Right. And I would choose light-colored clothing, as mentioned, and also they make some really nice outdoor clothing that is long sleeve and long legged, and they're not too hot, right? So the stakes get ramped up depending on what you're doing, and if you're working in brush and you're or traveling internationally to places where some of these diseases are imminently life threatening, then you have to take those actions. I think again we have to change our behavior as we recognize that these insects are not just an annoyance, but are potentially causing diseases that, you know, require antibiotic use or can even threaten our lives.
Yeah, with triple E especially, hearing you, and other tick-borne diseases like anaplasmosis and so forth. Jonathan, how about you? If I saw you sort of working out in the yard or hiking in the woods near your house, what would you look like?
So, I mean, I do typically try to wear long pants. Not always the best on the long sleeves on the for the top, but deep for sure. I don't have permethrin clothes, but it is a good idea. I have two little ones, so I don't go too far into the woods, just because they don't get too far.
Yeah, well, I'm always kind of resistant. Maybe I shouldn't admit this on the air, but I feel like 8 months out of the year, I'm bundled up. And finally, right. You know, May, June, July, August, I can sort of not wear long sleeves and long pants. Thank you very much. So I have to say, Dr. Talbot, I'm kind of resistant to the idea of wearing long sleeves and long pants. I'm tired of being covered up. I know I'm whining.
We all weigh risk-benefit, right, cost-benefit differently. And if you would rather incur risk for these vector-borne diseases, then, you know, you have that autonomy, Laura. I am more risk-averse because I'm on the side of treating patients and hearing some of the horror stories. So for me, it's well worth avoiding, you know, sun exposure, tick exposure, mosquito exposure. So I tend to be, as an infectious disease doctor, somewhat of a wet blanket out there. And you know, again, I weigh it differently. So
sure.
You go.
Well, and let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people with questions. And Frank's calling from Bedford. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I am working on my lawn and painting my house. I came in Saturday. I had a tick, a tiny tick on my face.
Yikes.
And I sprayed my shoes and clothing with Cutter Backwoods insect repellent. And you folks mentioned permethrin this morning. I just went and got my Cutter. It is 75% DEET, but no permethrin. What products contain that? I went online and I found something called Sawyer Premium Insect Repellent with permethrin, something you have to order online. Are there more common products that your experts know about? Because these ticks are driving me crazy.
Yeah.
I have one on my face is like, wow.
Yeah, really? You expect them maybe on your ankles, but jeepers, Frank. Thank you so much for the call. And Dr. Talbot?
Right. This came up before, too, right? That DEET is for your skin and permethrin is for the fibers of your clothing, your shoelaces, whatever. Your tents, your outdoor Adirondack chairs, if they have the cloth, you know. And there are many commercial formulations available. You looked online. I think that's a great way to do it. I think that each of our local hardware stores or Walmart kind of stores choose their own commercial brand, and you simply have to read the instructions per that formulation, whether it's spray on or you soak your stuff or how many washes it works for. But I think it's really underutilized, and we should be reaching for that more commonly, especially as we're getting out this summer.
Well, interesting. And you talk about fabric on outdoor chairs, so I hadn't even thought about that.
Good. Well, I'm surprised that you're still learning. You're on this show so often.
Every year we do this show, and every year I learn a lot. Most of it unpleasant, but still, you know, knowledge is power. Here's an email that came in from Ken. Are chipmunks carriers of Lyme? Should I worry, Ken says, about the hundreds that live in my yard? Ken, this is a great question. Jonathan, we talked about mice. We talked about voles. We talked about deer. What about chipmunks?
Yeah, so chipmunks can definitely carry ticks. So ticks can feed and can take a blood meal off a chipmunk. I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure that chipmunks are not good carriers of Lyme disease, though. So in particular, mice, and in particular here in New Hampshire, the white-footed mouse, those are the animals that the ticks get the Lyme disease from. I think chipmunks don't pass Lyme disease as well.
Well, and Joan asks, if I don't see deer in my yard, how did the ticks get there? Jonathan, it sounds like you're saying there are a lot of other carriers, and ticks just travel on their own. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so, well, they can't travel too far on their own. They're, you know, they're little critters, and they don't move too far, but they travel on everything. So if it's not a deer, it's a mouse or a raccoon. Birds. They'll travel on. They'll take blood meals from anybody.
Okay. Here's another email from Kathleen who says, "I just visited Alaska and they don't have ticks there yet anyway." Makes one ponder. Kathleen says, "Moving to another area to avoid ticks just to go outside." Kathleen says, "I was at a training the other day and the trainer mentioned creating a border around your yard with wood chips because she said ticks do not like wood chips. Is that something you've heard?" And Jonathan, I'll throw that to you again.
Yeah, so that's something that I mentioned earlier in the show. So it's basically getting them out so they're exposed and there's no place for them to hide. So there's no basically like brush or cover for them to get under. I think that's the function of wood chips. And the mechanism there is really you want to get them out in the open and dry them out. So they do not like when they can't be under brush and in a humid environment.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. And here's another one. This is from Deb. It's a positive story. Deb in Alstead. She says, I do dress in light colored clothing when doing yard work or hiking and do spray my clothing and tuck my pants into my socks, etc. Deb says, I have found putting my clothing in my dryer for about 20 minutes before washing is very successful. I used a magnifying glass to look at my lint trap after the dryer and have found several of the poppy seed size ticks in the lint trap. Yay, Deb says. She's won the battle in that instance. Valuable conversation. Thank you. And thank you, Deb, for the email. And just to wrap it up with both of you and Dr. Talbot, you first. The CDC says in this big, you know, report that we've been talking about, the nation needs to be better prepared to face this public health threat from these vector-borne illnesses. Again, ticks, mosquitoes, fleas. How good a preparation do you see by the federal government, Dr. Talbot, by local governments, in terms of facing this public health threat that the CDC outlines?
I think it's not so good. I'm frank about this, that I think the convenience samples, those that are easy to do of our ticks, understanding such as the researcher had earlier on the show, why do we have to do it piecemeal like that? How about we be funded for systematic surveillance and go out and do really careful studies of our ticks, how they're moving in our state, what diseases they carry? And then the second thing I think that we need better advocacy for is development of that vaccine. So we have technology. We know how to make a vaccine, but we need protections for the companies to be enabled and empowered to do that safely and bring it to market for availability more widely. So I think that those are two features that our government should take on more aggressively.
Yeah, I've wondered about that. The public really seems to want this. So whose responsibility is it, Dr. Talbot, to push this through? Is it docs like you? Is it the CDC? Who is it?
I think that there needs to be protections for the companies that would incur a great risk to develop these. So we need to work hand in hand, public-private partnerships and a greater awareness of the public to advocate for these things.
Well, both of you, lots of great information that you shared with us today. I really appreciate it. As I said, I always learn something new, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Thanks to everybody also who called, who sent in questions. And Dr. Talbot, it was good to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, Associate Professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Jonathan Winter, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome, Laura.
That's Jonathan Winter, Assistant Professor of Geography at Dartmouth College. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.